there's another.
Okay, good afternoon, everybody. Or I guess it's morning. I'm so used to saying that every afternoon that I forgot that we're at a special time today. We are going to take the order of business as follows. We're going to start by opening a work session on House Bill 2572. And I'll open that work session. Colleagues, this bill is on solely for the purpose of referring it to the Committee on Ways and Means. The request was made that an effort that's gone down there that I understand is a cooperative effort with no opposition. Parties that have worked out an agreement needed a bill that had a relating clause that was different than the one that they had that they were working on because of the context of their agreement. And with approval of the Speaker's office, they asked that we revive this bill for the purposes of sending it to the Ways and Means Committee. And so I would move that House Bill 2572 be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means without recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Any objection? All right. So showing Representative Crummell and Shetterly is excused, House Bill 2572 is referred to the Committee on Ways and Means without recommendation. Second order of business, I will open a work session on Senate Bill 342. Council.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you. Senate Bill 342 is the bill we heard testimony on yesterday. It deals with controlled substances and the intentional consumption of controlled substances. Briefly, yesterday we looked at the Dash 1 amendments, which were offered by Representative Przanski, which would, in the form of the Dash 1, would have been an add-on of allowing a school district board to expel a student who has twice been at school using controlled substance and under the influence of controlled substance. The Dash 2 amendments are the amendment that makes allows juvenile delinquency jurisdiction over a person, obviously, who's under the age of 18, who intentionally consumes controlled substance and was under the influence of controlled substance. Dash 3 is the amendment that we received from Department of Justice yesterday. Mr. Fussner was here. It's it's related to the Slovak case and would allow prosecutor to use any mixture of substance that contains controlled substance to be used to get to a substantial quantity, which elevates the sentencing guidelines, regardless of whether that controlled substance is in an ingestible or marketable form. The Dash 4s are going to be from Representative Przanski. They're going to have his amendment as a standalone gut and stuff of the bill. And then the Dash 5s are Representative Przanski's gut and stuff along with the Dash 3 on the Slovak fix.
So if I understand, Council, the Dash 5s would be a combination of the Dash 1s and the Dash 3s. Is that right?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. In the conversations I've had members of the committee yesterday, my sense was that there were sufficient votes to support the Dash 1s, and I thought that there were sufficient votes to support the Dash 3s. It did not appear to me that the committee was inclined to support the Dash 5s, the Dash 2s. And so if, in fact, the committee is disposed to support the Dash 1s and the Dash 3s from yesterday, then the way to do it would be to support a motion on the Dash 5 amendments that are in front of the committee today.
And Mr. Chairman, to clarify, and I think if the committee, the Dash 1s, we redrafted as the Dash 4, so it's a standalone. Originally, it was an add-on, so I think it would be the
Dash 4.
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, you want
to? Yeah, the Dash 4s. I apologize to committee and to council. We got them this morning, and I neglected to have my staff make copies for the committee. She's making them now. I'm going to pass one set to the chair, and it is just a standalone, basically the gut and stuff of putting what was the Dash 1s into the bill, and it would be the entirety of the bill.
Well, if we only added it on, there wouldn't be any reason to. I mean, the alternative was either the original bill or the dash twos as a replacement for the original bill, or as I understood it, the dash ones that you had prepared as a replacement for the bill. And that was your intent, was it not?
That was my intent.
Okay.
It's unfortunate that the dash ones came out as an add-on.
I see. But the dash fives, do the dash fives do the add-on, or do they, or are they also a replacement of the entire bill?
My understanding is the replacement with the dash ones and what was the dash three.
All right. So still, again, committee, if you're following this, if you supported the dash ones yesterday and Representative Kozanski's arguments on the dash ones and the dash threes, then today you would want to vote for the dash five amendments if there was a motion on the dash fives.
And Mr. Chair, there's been some discussion regarding what the dash threes provided, and I'm not sure if council was going to talk about his discussion with the AG's office this morning.
I'd be happy to, Mr. Chairman and Representative Przanski. I have Jennifer Lloyd is here from the Department of Justice. Representative Przanski and I talked about trying to look at a fix or a compromise, basically, of trying to get somewhere between the Slovic case and some other thing that might follow the federal guidelines in some way. I talked to the Department of Justice. Jennifer Lloyd's here, as I said, to answer questions. I think their position is they would rather not try to find that middle ground at this point and either have the, if the committee likes their amendment, go with that, and if not, that they would continue looking at an appeal to the Supreme Court. And Jennifer, I'm sure, could explain that.
I'm not sure it needs any additional explanation. I think we understand what their position is. Representative Przanski, with the combined amendment as the dash five, are you prepared to offer that amendment to the committee?
Mr. Chair, I will put that out for discussion. I think there's some of the members in my independent discussions had some issues with with the dash threes as to the quantity amounts. And I just think that maybe we would want to discuss that. So maybe before we actually do the motion, I was wondering if the chair would want us to maybe have that discussion and then move whatever is going to be most appropriate, if anything.
We can, sure. I mean, we can have a discussion about it. I think the discussion we had yesterday about the dash threes, I thought, was fairly sufficient, and we didn't get an alternative. There isn't an alternative to the dash three in front of the committee today, so it's either adopt what was presented yesterday in the dash threes as offered by the Department of Justice or not adopt something. We're not in a position, I think, at this stage of the game to craft a compromise amendment in committee. So my preference would be, I mean, if the committee wants to have a dialogue about the benefits and or lack thereof of the dash three amendments, that's fine. But my preference would be to sort of let's put them up and see how they fly, and if they don't, then we'll move on and deal with the rest of the agenda today. But if committee members feel the need to discuss, I recognize Representative Crummell was you're a bit disadvantaged having missed yesterday's meeting, Representative Crummell.
Should I just leave when the vote's going to be taken, and then
no, would be just. You just follow the signals, Representative.
In that case, then call on me last.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative.
I'll go ahead and move the dash fives for purpose of opening the discussion on the dash fives.
All right, Representative Przanski has moved the dash five amendments to Senate Bill 342. Discussion.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I think the only issue that came to my attention from the discussions yesterday is the way we have this worded, potentially you are going to have individuals that could be charged at a higher level of crime in the sense of the amount of substance than is actually there. What I heard yesterday is that when you have these type of chemical compounds being made, it in some cases takes into some type of liquid form that could be in volume of a gallon, but when it's finally processed for street sale or use, it's down into grams. And the way the system is set up, they could, in fact, if they are caught prior to having finished product, to be charged at a higher level of quantity than what they would have if they were actually completed the process and were out selling it on the street. And so that's... I think that's a policy shift based on what we have, and that's something I just thought that we would want to discuss and figure out if there's some way that we could actually fix it. And I understand at this late time, we probably aren't going to be able to fix it.
And I appreciate the concern. I thought a little bit about this last night, actually, as I was driving home. And, you know, this rationale, if I thought about it long enough, might not be very effective. But it did dawn on me that one of the differences is that if you're someone out on the street possessing that small quantity, you know, you may have been involved in the manufacturer. You may have received it through some other distribution network to the point where you're now selling it or in possession of that quantity. But this committee has spent a lot of time particularly talking about the negative impacts and the real costs and consequences to the system of the manufacture of methamphetamine. And while the drug that you might be talking about in its small state, if it were through the entire refinement process, might not be very high, the byproducts of that process, the poisons, the toxins, you know, the rat poison, the phosphorus, and all the other stuff that's used to manufacture these products, the glassware, the sludge, all the stuff, you know, it seems to me, in my mind, to ought to have been in some way, or ought to be in some way, sort of included in the level of the crime, and in elevating that crime to the extent that it's the involvement in the actual manufacture. And I guess I'm less bothered by you know, catching somebody who, if you went through the full refinement process, it'd only be this much, but all that stuff used in the process of refinement, which is bad in of itself, I guess it doesn't shock my conscience. And I recognize that the logic on that might be a bit attenuated, but it doesn't seem to changed my mind when I woke up this morning. So, Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Your very persuasive argument didn't change my mind, which happens to be on the other side, probably, of this issue. Specifically, I guess, and I have a question for those of you who have gone through the trouble of going to law school and studying all this stuff for many years, is there not another category of crime having to do with manufacturing of controlled substances that is at a higher level than the and if that is the case, then I really have difficulty you know, with this particular move, because there's another statute that people can be prosecuted under that would have a higher level of crime, mm-hmm. or would be considered higher.
I think you make an excellent point, Representative.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, to answer that, I think the answer is there is not a higher level of manufacturing or delivery of a controlled substance than what you'd have with a substantial quantity. Or a what's called a commercial drug offense, where you could have, there's two ways you can elevate a manufacturing or delivery or a possession. For the manufacturing and delivery, those are normally six on the sentencing guidelines, so they'd be on that tier of level six. You can raise it to an eight with this form of having a substantial quantity of the drug. To my mind, that's the highest you could get with manufacturing. And there's only two ways to get to that level 8. That would be with the substantial quantity, or if you can prove what's called a commercial drug offense. And in that proof, you'd have to prove the existence of things like a firearm, currency along with a drug, and things like that.
Representative Ackerman, Representative Ackerman.
Yeah, I think we're a little bit off the point. The original bill was going to criminalize by a sanction of a violation for consumption by possession, okay? What we're doing now is to make it a school disciplinary matter subject to suspension of driver's licenses. And I think that as long as we're doing this not in the criminal format but in the civil format and making it a disciplinary matter for school districts, the lower standard doesn't bother me. That is, to go to not necessarily a marketable amount would have to be proven, but one that was did not have a marketable amount. Otherwise, I don't see how you could ever have a sanction for possession by consumption if you had to prove a marketable amount of the drug itself. So I guess what I'm saying, I think we're sort of decriminalizing this, and I don't feel, by doing that, I don't feel uncomfortable with a lower standard.
I think, though, Representative Ackerman, if I could, and maybe I've misread it, but I think what's happening here is we've got the dash ones that were proposed by Representative Brzezinski, which was the school issue. And then this bill is being used as a tag-on with the dash threes to deal with a completely separate issue that the Department of Justice is attempting to put in there. So I'm not sure that there is a relationship on the marketable amount issue between the dash threes and the dash ones. And it sounds like there may be enough concern about the dash threes that instead of moving the dash fives as a combined amendment, why don't we just do the dash fours and the dash threes independently, and we'll just see where we end up. And that way people can feel like they can vote how they wish on the two separate issues.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Brzezinski.
I'd like to amend my motion, and instead of moving the dash fives, I will move the dash fours into Senate Bill 342.
Okay. So Representative Brzezinski moves the dash fours, which, if you're keeping track, were essentially the dash ones yesterday, for Senate Bill 342. Is there discussion on the dash four amendments?
Now, Mr. Chair, I just want to make sure that I'm caught up to speed here. The dash four amendments are a gut and stuff also, correct?
They are. Mm-hmm.
So we would actually be then getting rid of the all of the provisions dealing with consumption and possession based on weight. Is that, am I correct in that?
Well, that issue would come up in the dash three amendments that we're going to talk about in a moment. Yes. But the ones that relate to the student on consumption issues will go out, and it will be the dash one amendments, or excuse me, the dash four amendments will be essentially the new version of the bill.
Mr. Chair, if you'd like, since Representative Crummell wasn't here, I can maybe just go over that real quick.
Real quick.
The dash fours will just be a substitute for the original bill. It will allow school districts an opportunity to have an additional tool, so when they have individuals that are coming to class either using or under the influence of controlled substances on school property or at school functions, that they can, in fact, have them not only expelled and suspended, but one of the other tools will be to lose their driving privileges for having that conduct in twice. There's a process that the school boards already have in for their drug policies or other policies that will still have to be met, and then that's the process. So it's really giving another enforcement action to try to keep young people from engaging that conduct.
Mr. Chair, Representative Brzezinski, in addition to enforcement, then, was there discussion yesterday relative to intervention and what kinds of interventions are utilized and how this enforcement type of action and loss of driving privileges sort of interfaces with the intervention?
Yes, I'll just give the example. I told the committee yesterday that I pulled the policies from all of the school districts with the exception of Pendleton, which we weren't able to get for all of the districts. Portland School District, what they have is for mandatory consequences, first violation except for settlement transfer, they rank it as a level A, then they have a level B, and then they have two or three different steps they will sanction young people. And one of the things that's required that came out yesterday in our conversation was having these type of therapy programs required. In Portland, they require approved therapy programs to be completed not at district expense. And so it's not a cost to the school, at least in this school, in that particular school district. So each school district has their own policies that they have to comply with and students have to comply with. And then this will just add an additional, hopefully, tool or mechanism to get young people to not violate the policy.
Okay, so the motion is to move the dash fours to Senate Bill 342. Representative Jensen.
I'll support the dash fours. However, I do so with reservations. I have some concern about due process in here. And additionally, I have concern about unequal treatment. Those individuals who do not have or do not wish to have or whatever driver's license is not being subject to the same kind of penalty. I have some serious questions about those. But
Representative Barker, don't go too far. We're going to vote. All right. Thank you, Representative Jensen. All right. So the motion is on the dash fours. Why don't we call the roll, Ann?
Okay. Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Aye. Representative
McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Prozonsky?
Aye.
Representative Jetterly?
Excused.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Aye. Dash fours are in the bill. Chair would move the dash three amendments with the following provisions, colleagues, because the dash threes were an add-on, striking essentially lines 1 through 5. So the dash three amendments would simply include the addition of section 13 and the emergency clause in section 15. Section 14, which was unrelated to the concept of the dash three when it was a standalone amendment, would come out. So it would be sections 13 and 15, which is consistent with the information that was provided to us yesterday by the Attorney General's office. Discussion. We've heard from Representative Jensen on the dash threes. Do you want to comment again?
Merely that I will not be supporting.
Okay. Any other discussion?
So I want to, Mr. Chair, I want to make sure that I understood what you said. Section 13 would stay in the amendment.
Yes.
Section 14 comes out.
Yes.
And section 15 stays in.
Yes.
Okay. So the language that we're really dealing with here then is basically on page 5, lines 11 through 13, talking about the mixture or substance and what that means.
That is accurate.
Okay.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. While I understand that there may be a concentration that can be affected in this mixture or substance, I think it's pretty clear that this is a dangerous substance that we're dealing with. And I really feel that we need to encourage law enforcement by adding this section and making it an important part of this. I certainly will support this.
Okay. Let's call the roll on the dash threes.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
No.
Representative Crummell?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
No.
Representative Prozonsky?
No.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Aye. Dash threes are in the bill.
Chair.
Yes, Representative Prozonsky.
I'll move SB 342 as amended by the committee to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Prozonsky moves Senate Bill 342 as amended by both of those amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Okay, call the roll.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Crummell?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Prozonsky?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Aye. Senate Bill 342 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Prozonsky?
You'd like.
If you'd carry it, that would be fine. Thank you. We're now going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 297. I'll announce to the attendees. We're going to lose our Democrat members at noon for a Democratic caucus meeting, and I've been in consultation with the Speaker's office. This committee, it's the what was the old Mark Twain quote? The rumors of my demise are greatly exaggerated. Well, the rumors of this committee's demise are greatly exaggerated. This committee will meet on Monday. I would anticipate that we would actually have a vote on this bill on Monday, or at least in work session for the consideration of the bill and the amendments. So I view today as an opportunity for the participants with amendments, and they are, who said, didn't we use the word yesterday, panoply. Wasn't that the word that got used yesterday? Today it is a veritable cornucopia of amendments to this bill. So I encourage the people offering amendments to come up, explain to the committee what the amendment does. We've got a half hour, so I'm going to be conscious of both sides getting an opportunity to present their amendment in explanation. You'll have some opportunity, obviously, on Monday and for the remainder of the day, to the extent you can corral members to help them better understand that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Mr. Taylor.
We have had more amendments come in since this morning. I think we've had probably at least six or seven of them. I see Representative Butler has just arrived, and I understand that he is the author of the Dash 16 amendments. I also understand that I got some amendments this morning from Representative McPherson, which would be the 17 and 18. As to the other amendments, the 6, 7, 8, 9s, 10s, 11s, 12s, 13s, 14s, 17, and 18s, well, up to 14, I would suggest that we hear from Mr. Monroe and Mr. Gallagher to explain what the amendments are and to identify where they're from.
Okay, and I want to be cognizant of Representative Butler's time so he can get back to business, so I'm going to start with, and I don't know if you heard my earlier speech, Representative Butler, we're going to lose our quorum at 11 o'clock or 12 o'clock for a Democratic caucus meeting. So if you could just briefly inform the committee about what the Dash 16s do, I'd appreciate it.
It appears that maybe you've lost them already, a couple of them anyway.
Well, we'll get them back.
All right. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tom Butler from House District 60, Ontario. I've had a personal experience dealing with contaminated soil. One that I thought would probably rip my guts out if it didn't take my heart away, because when we got the first estimates in, the low estimate was nearly $800,000 to take care of a piece of contaminated soil that we had the deed on. The first thing we did was we immediately began to try and mitigate our own damage, because that's what my parents had always taught me to do, was try and do as much as you possibly can without trying to shift the burden to someone else. When we were done, the bill came in at around $200,000. We were able to sit down with the insurance companies and resolve that amicably over a very short period of time. And we kept the price low because we were able to mitigate our damages as soon as we possibly could. I'm anxious about what the current status of Senate Bill 297 does. Therefore, I am proposing the Dash 16 amendments to the A and Gross 297. The Dash 16 merely moves this over to a task force on contracts for insurance covering environmental claims in the interim, with two members of the House and two members of the Senate. Specifically, that we will look at the claims management, payments, the duties and responsibilities of both the insureds and the insurers. I believe that rather than have Oregon move out into territory which is basically untried waters, that it would be very important for us to very carefully go through the insurance issues with this state without trying to force out insurance companies or to try to find the deep pockets which will eventually raise the rates for all of us, and which would have the disquieting effect of potentially forcing insurance companies out of the state of Oregon. With that, I'd be happy to take any questions, but there are folks, I'm sure, in the room that will be testifying that you could ask about any of the issues that I've raised in the Dash 16 amendments, Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you very much for your concise testimony, Representative Butler. Is there anything for Representative Butler? Okay, thank you. We'll consider your amendment. Okay, this is difficult to keep track, colleagues, but my understanding is, if I go back to amendments, the A6s were amendments offered by Mr. DiLorenzo. The A7s are amendments offered by the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and they've been superseded, as I understand, by the A14s. So if you're like me and you don't want to get confused, draw a big line through your A7 amendments, because they are no longer under consideration of the committee. The A6, I believe, is still under consideration of the committee, and I don't know that they've been superseded. That then takes us to the stack of new amendments that we have in front of us. I have in my possession an A8, an A10, an A11, an A12, an A13, an A14, an A17, and an A18. I do not have in my possession an A9, and I do not have in my possession an A15. So in that order, I will ask the proponents, and I think if I'm right, it's Jack, are you the A8, 9, 10, and 11s?
I am.
Would you come up and bring, if you need to bring somebody to actually tell us what they do, you're welcome to.
Okay.
Which ones are these? 8, 8?
I think we're on the 8, 9s, 10s, and 11s. I don't have a 9, so I don't know that there is a 9. So I'm on the 8, 10, and 11.
8, 10, and 11.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jack Monroe with the American Insurance Association. I'm joined by Greg Baird with the Portland law firm of Gordon and Pulser. Clearly, I'll just explain the amendments, and you hopefully remember enough about the arguments or the discussion on Tuesday to recall what they're directed toward. If I might, I'll take them out of order for just a second. The 810 amendments simply deleted the allocation language that's in Section 2. That's what the 810s are directed toward doing.
Let me make sure that we understand that. So when you say the A-10s delete the allocation, does that mean the all-sums language?
The all-sums language.
So if we adopted the A-10s, the bill would be left simply as a loss policies bill with no treatment of the all-sums issue.
That is correct. I guess just by way of explanation, but with the thought that this might be the committee's last meeting, it sort of made sense to have every option covered potentially, and that's why at least the number of amendments are here that I've offered. Reverting back to the A8s, the A8s simply offer up what I will describe as a menu to replace the all sums language that's in Section 2. And if you read the A8s, what you will discover is that it simply says that depending upon the facts and the policies that that a judge has in front of him or her, he could select one of the two options that are here, the two options being a pro rata allocation system or an all sums allocation system. So it would give a jurist the option, depending upon the facts and the insurance contracts and the other considerations that are before the party, the choice of selecting an allocation system.
Can I ask about that? Just sure. And maybe Mr. Baird would want to chime in on this. Would the A8s fundamentally be considered, though, frankly, maintaining status quo? I mean, those arguments are currently made, and the court currently has the ability to select either between an all sums or a pro rata allocation. So is there anything ultimately with the adoption of the A8s that's really changing from the way the current process works?
I think the answer to that is no.
Okay.
It simply is a reflection of...
All right.
But a statutory statement, obviously, that they have that.
So it just reiterates what's already in...
What's already happening, right.
But it's obviously adding it to the code
rather than just having it be done by the judicial correct. System. Got it. Okay.
Mr. Chair, if I might add to that.
You might identify yourself.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm Greg Baird, a partner with the law firm of Gordon & Pulser in Portland. I've been involved in a number of environmental insurance coverage cases, along with my partner, Diane Pulser. This amendment will actually restrict the choices that a court has in selecting an allocation methodology for defense and indemnity costs. It limits the choices to the court to the all sums or the pro rata, which is the time on the risk methodology. I would merely note for the record that there are a number of other allocation techniques that have been adopted and are advocated in various cases depending on the facts and the types of policies. So although this would be typical of some cases you may see, there are other allocation techniques that this legislation would take out that may be advanced in litigation today.
Okay. That's helpful. Thank you.
Thank you. The next amendment that is at least identified with our interest is the A11, and it addresses the issues that were noted on Tuesday relative to loss policies. And If you recall, Laura Foggin, the party who was with us from Washington, D.C., she had indicated to the committee that the language that's here, meaning that language that's in the printed bill, is not identical to the Washington language and wasn't as reciprocal as seemed appropriate in terms of the obligations that were being placed on the two parties. The language that's here is her effort and our effort to both clarify and make those obligations reciprocal. The other issue that we discussed on Tuesday that's addressed here, you will recall that we addressed the issue of whether or not the standard of proof for determining the elements of loss policies ought to be clear and convincing, highly probable, or whether it ought to be the preponderance standard, more likely than not. And that this particular version incorporates the clear and convincing standard of proof. The third element that's in this measure or in this amendment is the enforcement provision, and I think Representative Prasansky was the one who mentioned that. This particular measure has the divisions, I think we said A6, I'm A7 language, so it has language that, at least relative to that issue, that differs from the most recent offering of the division. Now I would let me skip to another amendment you have, which is the A15. The A15 amendment is absolutely identical to the A11.
We don't have an A15.
You don't.
We've got a 12, 13, 14, okay. Well, 16, 17, 18.
I will put an A15 in front of you. I will describe it. It is identical to the A11s, except the standard of proof is different, meaning it has preponderance language in it.
Okay. So the A15 and the A11 are the same with the exception of the standard.
That is correct, Mr. Chairman. And I apologize. I just acquired it. I obviously forgot to...
Can you get a copy? He's got it in his hand, and distribute a copy of the A15s for us.
I apologize. Huh?
Okay.
Okay, and the other, I guess the only other amendment that I think is identified with our interest is the A13. And if you recall, there was a discussion on Tuesday, I'm sorry, I won't be able to, I guess, pare it back with Mr. Gallagher, who I think introduced at least the issue, had to say, because I was out of the room. But essentially, the issue was the ambiguity or apparent ambiguity in Section 2, Subsection 3, no, Subsection 4, small d, which dealt with insured, or, you know, periods when the insured had either self.
What amendment are we on?
We're on the A13.
I'm sorry. The A13. Which dealt with questions about how the insured was to be treated during periods when they were self-insured or uninsured.
And tell us what it does.
And I think maybe I'll with that, maybe I'll turn it over to Mr. Baird, and I think he was both sitting for the entire discussion on Tuesday and probably can
Mr. Chair,
do justice to 13.
In the committee, the concern with the language in the originally proposed bill is that self-insured is ambiguous and doesn't clarify the situations where an insured would be subject to a contribution allocation for failing to obtain coverage that would apply in the context of pollution liability coverage. Amendment A13 is intended to alter that and define self-insured to mean an insured is self-insured when they do not have liability insurance that would respond to a pollution liability claim. The concern is there are many situations where an insured purchases general liability coverage that does not provide coverage for pollution, either through an express exclusion, an endorsement, or otherwise. under the original version and an alternative proposed amendment before you today, an insured who knowingly purchased general liability insurance that would not cover pollution liability would not be subject to an allocation as self-insured, even though they had obtained coverage that did not provide coverage for pollution. The amendment A13 is intended to address that scenario where the insurer purchases coverage that will not respond to pollution losses.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Crummell.
Thank you. So I just want to clarify what you're saying, because does not respond could have some ambiguities of its own. From the standpoint of if an insurance company said, well, we don't think that the policy included, even though it might not be specifically excluded, we don't think that the policy excluded environmental claims. So we're not going to respond. Based on this language then, is the court supposed to find then that the entity was in fact self-insured?
My understanding and the intent of the language is that it is intended to apply where a court has determined that the insurance policy's terms actually do not provide coverage.
Okay. Thank you.
Your colleagues, you just got handed the dash 15, so if you're keeping notes like I am, you'll recall that Mr. Monroe said the dash 15s are the same as the dash 11s, except it uses a preponderance standard as opposed to the clear and convincing standard. Otherwise, he suggested that they're identical.
Which one is clear and convincing standard?
The clear and convincing standard is the 11. The preponderance of the evidence standards are the 15.
Okay. Wait, where did my 11?
Any other questions, counsel?
Mr. Members of the committee, Mr. Monroe, could you point out in the 11s and and 15s whereabouts in the amendment the preponderance of?
They had, Mr. Chair, committee counsel, you would go to page 3, line 9 in the A11s.
Thank you.
And in the A15, it would have to be somewhere in the same area, I would guess.
Line 9.
On the first page, did you say?
No, on the third page.
Third.
In both bills, line 9.
Thank you.
Otherwise, the bill should be identical, or the amendment should be identical.
All right. Are there other questions for either of these gentlemen on either the 8s, 9s, 10s, 11s, 13s or 15s. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned, I believe, on the A11s there was enforcement check. What is the enforcement? Where is that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I think subsections 11 and 12 on page 3 of at least the A11s, and I would presume it's in the same location on the A15s. That is the language that was in the insurance division's A7 amendments, which essentially the issue that Representative Przanski raised was who's the enforcing authority here, and the statutes are actually in a DEQ sequence chapter. DEQ doesn't want that responsibility and really isn't equipped to deal with it. The insurance division obviously is the party that is most equipped to deal with it, and so this was an effort to be.
So it's the party that enforces, not the enforcement itself.
This was an effort to be responsive to that concern.
Okay. Well, thank you for briefing us on the amendments.
Thank you.
I think I'm going to go next. It's going to be you, Tom. It's going to come forward. And you're the
A12. We only have one amendment, Mr. Chair. That's dash 12.
Okay.
Dash 12?
Yeah. And
hope you appreciate the musical serenade to the strings of the Flintstones as we're...
I was thinking how appropriate that was. Mr. Chair, the dash 12s are the three things that we said we would do after the last hearing, and it's going to take me a couple of seconds to explain how they were done. If you look at the dash 12s on line 4, it says delete line 4. That's on page 3. That's the subsection D that essentially is a catch-all subsection on who, which insurer we should select, which can be read to negate A, B, and C. So we've deleted that catch-all phrase. On line 23 on page 3, with the self-insured insured ambiguity, we have selected the language, failed to obtain general liability insurance. There are a number of tough legal issues in their amendment to this section, and quite simply we're trying to point out that if somebody went there during this time period pre-1985, they did not buy insurance, general liability insurance, that they share in the allocation of the risk. They pay their share for that time period for which they did not have general liability insurance coverage. Lines 8 on down on page 4 is Holly Robinson's way of writing in the mutuality. And what she does is, if you look at page 4 of the bill, on the first part of the section, in line 2, it says B, it says the insurer and the insured shall cooperate in determining the terms of the loss policy. And then in each place where there's an obligation, she inserts insurer and insured. We had asked to put in a provision of mutuality, but she thought that this was a better way to do it. And while I talk about Holly's good drafting here, let me talk just a second about the preponderance of the evidence controversy in front of you. And I will give you a copy of this to staff so that you have it. I'm reading from the Washington Rule 284-30-920, which reads, if it is concluded that a general liability insurance policy more likely than not was issued to the insured by the insurer. So that's the standard in Washington, more likely than not. For clarity of Oregon law, Holly has put that down as preponderance of the evidence. I would leave it to you to decide whether more likely than not is clear and convincing or preponderance in the Washington rule as we attempt to get to square there. The last thing I would like to do, Mr. Chair, is submit for the record letters from the Portland Business Alliance and from the Columbia Corridor Association supporting this bill. I'll just give those to staff.
Okay, thank you, and they'll be received. Let me ask quickly on the for you to respond to the language of the dash, if you have had a chance to look at it, and I know these are hitting everybody late, but on the dash A13s, and maybe Ms. Snyder could respond, you've attempted to address the issue of the concerns raised in Tuesday's hearing on the self-insured and insured issue. In one way, here they've defined it a different way. So you define it as failing to obtain a general liability insurance policy. Here they say insured does not have insurance that responds to liability from environmental claims regardless of the reason. I mean, those are differences, and I want the committee to understand sort of the distinction between those two amendments.
Mr. Chair and representatives, I'm Joan Snyder from Stoll Reeves. I'm here representing Snitzer. And that is an interesting question because it's very significant, and I guess the best way for me to explain the significance is to look at the policies post-1985 and explain a little bit about how environmental underlying claims are handled. If you have a release from your facility, say that occurred in 1984, an oil tank leaked, and you fixed the leak, and nothing ever happened behind 1984. So it was a one-year release to the ground. As far as the environmental law is concerned, that release continues to occur because the oil is now in the ground, and it is migrating through the groundwater, and so there is a constant damage occurring to the groundwater. And so what happened in about 1985 is that the insurers start writing policies with absolute pollution exclusions. And generally what happened is it was insurance to protect against environmental risk was unavailable post-1985. And this is what many of the courts that have looked at this from an allocation standpoint have said, is that for a period of time there, until they came up with some other environmental insurance vehicles in the late 90s, there simply was no insurance available. So what would happen under that case if this was in effect is that we would say, okay, the insurer, and say the claim is filed in 2002, you would say the insured has 1 year of coverage because there was that 1 year, 1984 to 85, that they wrote that policy. But the policyholder has, I have to do my math here, 18 years of liability or allocated liability because that release has continued to occur for 18 years. So on those facts, if you had this language, you would say the insured does not have insurance that responds from 1985 until 2002, and therefore they're going to be liable pro rata for 16/17 of all the costs of that claim, even though all that happened during their, you know, this time period, first of all, is that they couldn't obtain insurance if they wanted to, and second of all, that the release continued to migrate. And the courts in the, I know at least the New Jersey courts have addressed this, and what they have said is that we are not going to count it against a policyholder if they could not obtain insurance, because that simply isn't fair. And that's the same approach that we would recommend that the committee take here. So we are opposed to this amendment. Our A, help me, 12, suggests the language that this pro rata allocation to the policyholder occurs if the policyholder failed to obtain insurance. And that's what we heard when we were on the Senate side, that people were very concerned that if someone just simply didn't buy insurance and invited this to happen, that we should not let them get away with putting this burden on the insurer. And we agreed with that and accepted that amendment, and that's how that came into the bill.
Okay. And I'll give the other folks an opportunity to respond as well. But
The 13s came from who?
13s were Mr. Monroe's amendments.
Oh, okay.
And they... So it would be the insurance industry's effort to address this issue of what uninsured means. And here they define it as that the insured does not have insurance that responds to liability from environmental claims, regardless of the reason. So there's the distinction between those two policy issues. Was there any other amendment that you had to offer, Tom, or was it just the 12s?
No, Mr. Chair, that's all.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Krummel.
This is might be more editorial than anything, but I'm just curious. In reading that first line deal on page 4, the way that this is constructed, it appears as though it would say the insurer and the insured shall cooperate with the insured in determining, say, for example, on line 2, in determining the terms of a loss policy, and then it goes on. In that kind of an instance, is that an editorial thing that the editors will pull out the additional with the insured, or is that something that needed to have been put into the amendment?
Mr. Chair, I read it in the amendment that on line 9 of the amendment it said delete with the insured and insert with each other.
You're absolutely right. I didn't read far enough. Thank you.
I read it more times than you got a chance to, Representative.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you both. Appreciate it. We'll try to stay on time, and I want to give Representative McPherson an opportunity to talk about the 17s and 18s. First, Mr. Mortar, do you want to come up and just briefly touch on the 814s? This is your revised version of the A7s. Is that right?
Yes. Good afternoon. For the record, I'm Michael Mortar. I'm with the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and the Dash 14s represent some concerns raised actually by Representative Ackerman to us, and he felt that it was important, and we concurred to clarify the provisions under which we would enforce the loss policies.
Okay. All right. Is there any questions about the A14s? Show of hands from the opponents and the proponents of the bill. Does anybody have a problem with the A14s as they're currently drafted? Everybody's okay? All right. So there's one. The A14s. Don't move it yet, Floyd. Don't move it yet. No, go ahead. Did you have a question?
No.
All right. Good. All right.
You're going to move the A14s?
Yeah, right. Okay. No questions then. Thank you both very much. Appreciate it. Representative McPherson, that leaves you to discuss the A-17s and A-18s.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This was a response, the preparation of these two amendments, to the discussion that occurred the other day, and my sense formed about the problem here that we have an area of activity in which when it occurred, at the time the policies were written, the exposure to environmental law liabilities was not within the contemplation of either insured or insurer. What we're essentially doing in this area of activities, we're saying a policy was written that said was covered all risks for all sums, and a liability not contemplated as then coming to the fore and hitting potentially the insurer. And I think many courts have applied those policies as they're written to hold the insurer to the responsibility even for a risk that was not within the contemplation of the parties at the time. The defense cost piece, however, it seems to me, is probably something that in the setting of environmental litigation is potentially far greater than what would be ordinarily expected by an insurer when it writes a policy to cover a liability and then up to a policy limit and then unlimited defense costs. These amendments are a response to the defense cost piece. What the A-17s do is to make it clear what I think probably would be the appropriate interpretation of the bill in its current form, which is that where there is a period in which the property owner has no insurance in effect, that there is no obligation on the part of the insurer to front the defense costs and then have to claim them back from the property holder at a later time. They can apply an offset at the time the defense costs are provided. So that, taking a simple example where there was insurance in place for half of the relevant period, the property holder could get half of the insurance for the defense costs advance and would have to pick up the other half. They wouldn't get 100% paid by the insurer and then have a duty to go back and make a claim against the property holder at a separate time by treating, as the bill says now, treating the property holder as though it were an insurer making contribution. The A-18s go to a somewhat more complicated issue, which is that there is an open question, as I understand it, in the litigation over environmental liabilities as to whether the cost of remedial investigation and the feasibility study, which are very substantial costs in this area of activity, whether they are defense costs or not. This language does not attempt to resolve that point, but deals with how they relate to the policy limits if they're treated as defense costs. And it does so by treating the remedial investigation, which is the first phase, as a defense cost not subject to policy limits to the extent the court would otherwise so find. But then once the policy, an amount equal to the policy limits has been reached, that at that point, feasibility study costs, which it seems to me go more toward the process of then dealing with the problem, that is addressing the source of the liability, that those would be applied against the policy limits. So it's limiting the amount of exposure that an insurer has with respect to the unlimited defense costs as applied to the feasibility study portion of the work in certain circumstances. And it accomplishes the policy goal here of trying to make sure there's money up front to get the investigation work done. So that is would not be limited by policy limits. It would be treated as a defense cost if the court so finds. But the feasibility study, the next phase, would, if a certain magnitude had been reached, would be applied against policy limits. That is a very brief summary of what I got quite an education on from the stakeholders on both sides here over the last 24 hours, and I hope I haven't garbled it too badly.
Okay. Questions from Representative McPherson about either of his amendments. I did want to give both teams an opportunity to send somebody up to the table to comment on the dash 17s and 18s, if you so choose, before we lose the members. Jack, do you have anybody you want to send up, or do you want to come up yourself? And Tom, do you want to take a point?
I guess, Mr. Chairman, Jack Monroe for the American Insurance Association. I think my comment is very brief. We really haven't had a chance to take a look at these, and so I don't think I can offer you anything meaningful right now, and I think I'd like to defer that opportunity until Monday.
And your counsel is sitting very, very quietly next to you, which is just exactly the cue he was supposed to get.
Right.
Tom.
Mr. Chair, in 1991, I had the last bill of the session, which was holding up sine die by over a week. And a wise old lobbyist came to me and said, when the committee comes to you with the deal, take it. If this is a deal, if these folks can get to a place which is a compromise, we certainly would be foolish to turn it down. If they can't get there, we would be foolish to give up what we would win at another point in time.
Okay. All right.
Is that to be construed as a definite maybe?
Stay tuned till Monday.
Yeah, that's a stay tuned till Monday. Let me tell you what I am going to do. I appreciate all of you, and I appreciate the expeditious manner in which you presented your amendments to the committee, given our time constraints. Mr. Taylor's 4th of July homework project will be developing a matrix that lists the amendment by number, who offered it, and a brief description of what the amendment accomplishes. So on Monday, we'll have a playlist of what we're going to be looking at so we can sort of keep track. The committee, I would encourage you to be thinking about this as you're watching the fireworks go off from whatever location you will be at tomorrow. And prepare for the fireworks come Monday on this issue. And I would also encourage you, if you've got questions, because I know the holiday is going to impact everybody, I'm confident that the proponents and opponents to this measure who have offered these various amendments are going to be available to talk to you later this afternoon. So if there are questions that you still need answers to, don't let them get out of the building before you have your answers to mull over the weekend. Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does that mean that the chair of the committee will have his cell phone on so that when we want to call him to ask a question about where our thinking is going, that he'll be available to answer it on tomorrow?
Representative Jensen, I will take your call whenever and wherever I'm at. Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, with your permission, and I was going to ask the same question. As much as I like Representative Jensen, I wasn't planning to go to Pendleton. With your indulgence, Mr. Chairman, there was discussion on Tuesday about the loss policies, the standard of proof issue, and I think possibly a slightly incomplete discussion. I have a letter here that I'd like to distribute to members of the committee, and I'll do that with your indulgence.
Yeah, absolutely, and it'll be received, and she'll pass it out before we leave. Is there anything else? All right. Thank you, everyone. We are adjourned. Happy 4th of July.
Thank you.
I know.